Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Mother's Day is approaching, and for many of us, it's the perfect time to thank Mom for all she did when we were growing up. But how did she do it? Did she raise her children by instinct alone, or did she read some of the many books on child-rearing that have been published over the years? That's the topic of our program today, but first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1924, J. Edgar Hoover was appointed director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Probably the best-known FBI director of all time, Hoover began his career in law enforcement in 1917 as a member of the Department of Justice's Alien Enemies Bureau, where he processed German and Austro-Hungarian nationals for possible wartime internment. As FBI director, Hoover gained much of his reputation by directing hunts for Nazis, anarchists, communists, and other supposed subversives. He established an innovative FBI crime laboratory, a state-of-the-art fingerprint identification unit, and a system for analyzing crime statistics. However, he is also recalled for his insensitivity towards the civil rights movement in his smear campaign of Martin Luther King, Jr. Turning to an item of historical interest in the news, recently the Gulf Coast of Florida, just a few miles from Sarasota, was the scene of a mix-up of historic proportion. Late one Friday afternoon, Patricia Komkowitz and her daughter stopped to shop at a plaza near their home. When they returned to their car, they discovered a mysterious, neatly wrapped brown package in the back of their car. Wanting to do the right thing, they brought the package to their local police station. Fearing that it may be a bomb or some other type of dangerous device, the police called the regional bomb unit. After disarming the suspicious package with a water cannon, the crack unit discovered that they had destroyed two valuable portraits of George and Martha Washington, painted by the famous 18th-century American painter Gilbert Stuart. Fred Burroughs, who had borrowed the portraits, intended to mail them back to their owner in California. When he discovered that the post office was closed, he decided to do some shopping himself, and he tossed the package into the back seat of what he thought was his car. An insurance claim over the destruction of George and Martha is pending. You're listening to Talking History. In 1946, Dr. Benjamin Spock published Baby and Child Care, by which millions of American women raised their children. Spock's may be the most famous baby care book of our time, but it is not the only child-rearing manual ever written. Here to discuss the history of such manuals is Talking History's Dennis Mihalik.
Thank you, Brian. The annual Mother's Day celebration turns one's thoughts towards the rigors of parenting. Advice books line the store shelves. Here to put child-rearing manuals into historical perspective is Julia Grant, Associate Professor of Social Relations at James Madison College at Michigan State University, and the author of Raising Baby by the Book, published by Yale University Press. Welcome, Professor Grant.
Thank you.
The first obvious question, when and where did these child-rearing books originate?
Well, of course, I'm primarily interested in the United States, which is very similar to the English tradition, since many of our first child-rearing manuals were written by English-speaking people. The baby books really begin to come into play by the middle of the 18th century, and your first baby book writers are philosophers, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and physicians as well begin writing books for mothers around the mid-18th century. And by the beginning of the 19th century, you have a growing trend toward large numbers of child-rearing books written by these diverse kinds of authors.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they're giving advice, are they giving advice to men and women to raise children?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because really the early child rearing manuals were written primarily for men, especially if they concerned the education of older children, and it was thought that the fathers would really have the primary role in disciplining and rearing and educating older children. Mothers did have the care of infants, and books that were geared toward the care of infants were generally written for mothers by physicians in many cases. But the gender of the person reading the manual wasn't as specified as it would come to be in later years, since men and women really participated in many ways in the rearing of children, both young and old.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these early books, you say, going back as far as the mid-1700s, but then more important in the mid-1800s?
Right.
I mean, who's buying them?
Right. Well, obviously, it has to be a literate group of people, first of all. I think that's very important in the spread of child-rearing advice, that people had to be literate, they had to be readers, they had to have the income available to them to purchase these books. They also had to have some luxury. I mean, reading a book about how to train and educate your child is something that you can only be concerned about if you're already able to provide your child with the basic necessities of life. So one would have to say that the growing middle class in the United States that was fairly comfortably well off would be the group that would start out beginning to be purchasers of these books. And another point that I'd like to address is the fact that I think that child-rearing manuals become more necessary in part in response to geographic mobility, as women have to move with their husbands away from family and friends, and they're looking for sources of advice raising their children that maybe they couldn't get from their mothers or their aunts as they would have been if they lived in the same place that they had grown up in. Another aspect, I think, that helps to helps us to understand why these books became more necessary is that in a new republic like the United States, people no longer could guarantee their child's success in the world by virtue of their inherited status. Children had to earn their place in life, and therefore the socialization of the child became increasingly important. And it was a task that mothers were becoming more and more responsible for in their lives. As men began going out into the workplace and the division between men and women became more important in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And just along that line that you brought up now, would it be true then that that these manuals are much more important in the growing cities than they are in rural areas?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think one could say not necessarily, because we have a lot of evidence of interest in these things in larger villages where artisans and sort of perhaps a bit more of a literate middle class is beginning to take shape. For instance, upstate New York was a great territory for what they call maternal associations in the early 19th century, where women would sit around, and these were mainly attached to churches, and discuss different works on child rearing. And they were also popular in New England, not only in the large cities, but also in, for instance, western Massachusetts and places like that. It wasn't just in the cities, and that's not only where literacy was occurring either.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about these women's associations. I mean, did women publish these manuals?
Well, there were some women initially, as the manuals were beginning to come out, that did publish child-rearing manuals. There's one that I think is quite lovely called The Maternal Physician, written by a woman who argued that only a woman could understand these matters. That was published in 1811. There was also a feeling during the early days of child-rearing advice that when the psychology or philosophy of child-rearing was developed, it would be the work of women, since they were really the people that were thought to be the closest to understanding the mind of the child. Obviously, this didn't occur, but that was the thought in the early days of what they called child study.
Mm-hmm. Now, these books, I mean, they still exist, so, I mean, I can talk in the past and present tense. I mean, do these books tend to create an ideal child or childhood, you know, a certain set of values and behaviors that children are supposed to follow?
Well, obviously, I don't know if they actually create an ideal childhood. Certainly they reflect ideas about ideal childhood, and they certainly try to disseminate ideals of childhood. All of the books that are written, of course, are from the parents' perspective and are sort of geared at how parents can achieve the desired goal of childhood as defined by parents. We don't find really too much about real children in a lot of the books, but a lot about parents' ideals of what children should be like, in the sense that the middle class has sort of dominated the publication industry. They certainly did disseminate a middle class ideals of childhood that you could argue become ideals that other groups that may not actualize them in their own lives feel that they have to live up to, whether or not they are able to.
Mm-hmm. Now, has the advice changed dramatically over time?
It has. Perhaps not as much as we would think in certain ways. By the time that child-rearing advice books began coming out with Locke in 1699 and Rousseau, already attention had developed that I believe still continues today. That is between the sort of two purposes of childhood. And one would be sort of the idea of preserving the innocence of childhood and encouraging playfulness and joy and sort of what some might call now a progressive notion of childhood versus the more rational ideal of child rearing and childhood, the idea that you must raise your child to acquire adult virtues, and really the purpose of child rearing is training the child for adulthood. So one is sort of focused more on preserving childhood, and the other one is focused more on training the child for adulthood. And I think we're continually sort of going back and forth between those two tensions, and even today.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also it's widely attributed to Abraham Lincoln spare the rod and spoil the child. Which to a lot of parents today seems to be mean. What about discipline in these manuals?
Right. Well, my understanding is spare the rod and spoil the child initially comes from the Bible. So it's a pretty old precept. Some people still believe in it. Actually, corporal punishment is still pretty widely practiced, despite the fact that we're trying to get it out of certain kinds of institutions. It's clearly the case that there's been a change in the relationship of children to parents in terms of the degree of autonomy or even rights that we think that children should have. And this is reflected in what we find as acceptable discipline. And clearly there are kinds of discipline that were practiced even 20 or 30 years ago that are no longer, that would now be viewed as child abuse and neglect. And so I think that, yes, we certainly, as a society, do not countenance some of the kinds of punishments that were more typical in the past. I could give you examples about, I think it may still be practiced, but things that some of my women talked about in the 30s, tying children up in front yards to humiliating them or locking them in closets, et cetera, that were considered to be perfectly valid means of punishment, I don't think are acceptable anymore. But we do, I think, have a more child-centered view of parenting than we have in the past. I think that's pretty indisputable.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the psychologist versus the physician, is there a major difference between the kinds of advice that they give?
I would say not. One thing that occurred in this century is that psychology began to infiltrate the pediatrics, which really didn't come into being until the early decades of the century. And the most sort of influential, quote-unquote, pediatricians have been themselves very psychologically oriented. For instance, Benjamin Spock is perhaps the most famous example.
Right.
I don't really see any clear line of distinction in terms of the kinds of things they advise parents to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, in all the lists that have come at the end of the 20th century, I noted on several lists that Benjamin Spock was listed among the 100 most influential people of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's true?
I think that Spock was immensely popular and immensely successful. It's always questionable to me whether someone who writes books the way he did are merely sort of fulfilling a need and providing advice that people sort of already know but need to be reassured about, or whether he actually played the role of influencing parents. Spock's baby book came out in 1946, which was sort of the very beginning of the baby boom, and each edition coincided with a surge in the baby boom. Along with that baby boom, you had a great geographic dislocation in this country as people were coming back from the war and moving into new housing in the suburbs. So he really had a very ready audience of stay-at-home moms devoted to their children, sort of an unprecedented level of care and attention to individual children who were very oftentimes isolated from their family and friends, and while their husbands were out working at demanding white-collar jobs. And they were an incredibly receptive audience for Benjamin Spock's advice. I mean, even if they didn't weren't particularly interested in his child-rearing advice, just to be able at 3 o'clock in the morning to look up, you know, what to do if your child has diarrhea was invaluable for them at that time. And by the way, the book was really cheap, and in many cases it was given to them by their family physician. So it was a paperback, it was inexpensive, it was a great compendium of a lot of kinds of information, along with his child-rearing advice, which not all women were real happy with.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the stay-at-home mom, and today, of course, so much attention is paid to the working mom. Has women's liberation and mothers working affected the child-rearing movement?
Well, that's I think we might be too much in the heart of this to really know. Ultimately, I think one thing that's definitely changing is that we're going back to a more shared model of parenting. I don't think we're there yet, but we're certainly in the process of sharing parenting responsibilities between men and women, and that has got to have some kind of long-range consequences. As well, one could certainly argue that children are experiencing a greater range of social interactions, perhaps less intensity on the particular mother-child bond, in that they're going out into the world and sort of having what some people would say, having a social network of interactions that's perhaps closer to the colonial era than to the 19th century in some ways, where children weren't just really focused on that bond with one caretaker, but had a lot of kinds of relationships with caretakers and other people in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Professor Julia Grant, author of Raising Baby by the Book, published by Yale University Press.
18 years to get ready for this day. She should be past the fear. She cried so many ways. Oh, let it go. There's nothing in her way now. Let it go. There's room enough. And even though she spent her whole life waiting, it's never easy letting go.
One of the major items in the news these past several weeks has been Elian Gonzalez, who upon the death of his mother while attempting to flee Cuba for the United States became the focus of a tumultuous international child custody fight. Joseph Gonzalez, no relation to Elian, a PhD candidate in history at the University of Michigan, gives us his thoughts on the matter in an op-ed he has titled, Who is Responsible for the Elian Gonzalez Case?
Who is responsible for the plight of Elian Gonzalez? Fidel Castro? Bill Clinton? Well, if you want to hold someone responsible, then look to the Haitians. In 1994, the Haitians did us all a favor by exposing the double standard of U.S. immigration policy. Before 1994, the U.S. government gave automatic asylum to Cuban refugees, but not to other refugees. If the Haitians had not challenged this double standard in 1994, Elian would almost certainly be on his way to U.S. citizenship today. Before 1994, any Cuban who made it out of Cuba was automatically entitled to asylum in the U.S. For more than 30 years, hundreds of thousands of Cubans took advantage of this special treatment. Refugees from Haiti, however, had no claim to automatic asylum. From the 1960s to the 1990s, thousands of Haitians tried to flee Haiti's poverty and repression, but the U.S. government refused to grant Haitians automatic asylum. According to the U.S. government, Haitian refugees were fleeing poverty, not just political repression, and so it was argued they did not deserve automatic asylum. Today, U.S. immigration law treats Cubans and Haitians, for the most part, equally. Neither gets automatic asylum. If Cubans still received automatic asylum, Elian would be the latest permanent addition to Miami's Little Havana, rather than a celebrated legal case. The reason for this change has a lot to do with the events of 1994. In the summer of 1994, thousands of Haitians headed for the United States on crude rafts. Those who made it out of Haiti were interned in camps. At the same time, tens of thousands of Cubans headed for South Florida. The Cubans believed that they would receive automatic asylum in the U.S., but the Clinton administration was not sure that it should grant asylum to so many Cubans at one time. Until a final decision could be reached, the U.S. government decided to hold the Cubans in camps just like the Haitians. The Haitian and Cuban immigration problems converged on television. Both Cuban and Haitian refugees sat interned in camps, but only the Cubans stood a chance of staying in the U.S. To many Americans, this did not seem fair. In September 1994, the Clinton administration gave in and decided to treat Cuban refugees like Haitian refugees. No longer did the U.S. automatically grant Cubans asylum. Today, the U.S. Coast Guard tries to intercept and return Cuban immigrants to Cuba. The elimination of the double standard makes the case of Elian Gonzalez very complex. Before 1994, Elian would probably have been granted automatic asylum, but Clinton's changes to the immigration law have made Elian into a legal dispute and a political hot button. And we have no one but the Haitians to thank for this controversy. Their desire for better lives in the United States forced our government to abandon its double standard toward refugees from dictators. At the same time, without knowing it, the Haitians created the circumstances for the Elian Gonzalez case, a legal and political hot potato, such as the law of unintended consequences.
You've been listening to Joseph Gonzalez, Ph.D. candidate in history at the University of Michigan. Mr. Gonzalez's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. Expanding a bit on our earlier discussion of child rearing, for our site of the week, we recommend to you a place where you can investigate your family's history. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Utah Valley Regional Family History Center at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, is known for its expertise in tracking family histories. The Utah Family History Library offers trained volunteers who can help you sort through the myriad of information. Some of the major sources available at the library include census records from the U.S. between 1790 and 1920, and many other countries' records are available as well. There are even classes offered every second and fourth Sunday to help you learn how to do the research through the various sources available at the Family History Center.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, the History Channel has three interesting programs coming up. On Wednesday, May 17th, watch for The True Story of Robin Hood, the most famous, supposedly altruistic outlaw in history, around whom much myth and legend has grown. In this show, scholars of the legend separate fact from fiction, and the results are fascinating. On Thursday, May 18th, the History Channel will look at Sodom and Gomorrah, the most sinful cities in the Bible. Did they really exist? Were they destroyed by God's wrath, as reported in the Bible, or by some other, more earthly means? Tune in Sodom and Gomorrah and find out. And on Sunday, May 21st, look for another segment of Tales of the Gun. This program examines the weapons of some of the most famous men in history, including Teddy Roosevelt, Wild Bill Hickok, Pat Masterson, General Patton, Ulysses Grant, and Napoleon. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact time of these programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the history of the Peace Corps. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
There you go, my little one.